political police, Rudolf Diels. He indicated a slim, dark-haired man at his side. He has already arrested one of the perpetrators. Diels was not hysterical. Calmly, he said, Marinus van der Lubbe, a Dutch construction worker. And a communist, Göring said triumphantly. Diels said, expelled from the Dutch Communist Party for starting fires.
I knew it, said Hitler.
Lloyd saw that Hitler was determined to blame the communists, regardless of the facts. Diels said deferentially, from my first interrogation of the man, I have to say it is clear he is a lunatic, working alone.
Nonsense,
Hitler cried. This was planned long in advance. But they miscalculated. They don't understand that the people are on our side. Göring turned to Diels. The police are on emergency footing from this moment, he said. We have lists of communists, Reichstag deputies, local government elected representatives, Communist Party organizers and activists. Arrest them all, tonight. Firearms should be used ruthlessly. Interrogate them without mercy.
Yes, Minister, said Diels.
Lloyd realized that Walter had been right to worry. This was the pretext the Nazis had been looking for. They were not going to listen to anyone who said the fire had been started by a lone madman. They wanted a communist plot, so that they could announce a crackdown. Göring looked down with distaste at the muck on his shoes. My official residence is only a minute away, but is fortunately unaffected by the fire, my Führer, he said. Perhaps we should adjourn there.
Yes, we have much to discuss.
Lloyd held the door and they all went out. As they drove away, he stepped over the police cordon and rejoined his mother and the von Ulrichs. Ethel said,
Lloyd, where have you been? I was worried sick.
I went inside, he said.
What? Ow!
No one stopped me. It's all chaos and confusion. His mother threw her hands in the air.
He has no sense of danger, she said.
I met Adolf Hitler.
Walter said, did he say anything?
He's blaming the communists for the fire. There's going to be a purge.
God help us, said Walter.
3. Thomas Marker was still smarting from the sarcasm of Robert von Ulrich.
Your brother wants to move up in the world as you have,
von Ulrich had said.
Marco wished he had thought to reply, and why should we not? We are as good as you, you arrogant popinjay.
Now he yearned for revenge, but for a few days he was too busy to do anything about it. The headquarters of the Prussian secret police were in a large, elegant building of classical architecture at number 8 Prince Albrechtstrasse in the government quarter. Marker felt proud every time he walked through the door. It was a hectic time. 4,000 communists had been arrested within 24 hours of the Reichstag fire, and more were being rounded up every hour. Germany was being cleansed of a plague, and to Marker, the Berlin air already tasted purer. But the police files were not up to date. People had moved house. Elections had been lost and won. Old men had died and young men had taken their places. Marker was in charge of a group updating the records, finding new names and addresses. He was good at this. He liked registers, directories, street maps, news clippings, any kind of list. His talents had not been valued at the Kreuzberg police station, where criminal intelligence was simply beating up suspects until they named names. He was hoping to be better appreciated here. Not that he had any problem with beating up suspects. In his office at the back of the building, he could hear the screams of men and women being tortured in the basement, but it did not bother him. They were traitors, subversives, and revolutionaries. They had ruined Germany with their strikes, and they would do worse if they got the chance. He had no sympathy for them. He only wished Robert von Ulrich was among them, groaning in agony and begging for mercy. It was 8 o'clock in the evening on Thursday, March 2nd, before he got a chance to check on Robert. He sent his team home and took a sheaf of updated lists upstairs to his boss, Criminal Inspector Kringelein. Then he returned to the files. He was in no hurry to go home. He lived alone. His wife, an undisciplined woman, had gone off with a waiter from his brother's restaurant, saying she wanted to be free. There were no children. He began to comb the files. He had already established that Robert von Ulrich had joined the Nazi Party in 1923 and had left 2 years later. That in itself did not mean much. Macker needed more. The filing system was not as logical as he would have liked. All in all, he was disappointed in the Prussian police. The rumor was that Göring was equally unimpressed and planned to detach the political and intelligence departments from the regular force and formed them into a new, more efficient secret police force. Macker thought that was a good idea. Meanwhile, he failed to find Robert von Ulrich in any of the regular files. Perhaps that was not merely a sign of inefficiency. The man might be blameless. As an Austrian count, he was unlikely to be a communist or a Jew. It seemed the worst that could be said of him was that his cousin Walter was a social democrat. That was not a crime. Not yet. Macker now realized he should have done this research before approaching the man, but he had gone ahead without full information. He might have known that was a mistake. In consequence, he had been forced to submit to condescension and sarcasm. He had felt humiliated, but he would get his own back. He began to go through miscellaneous papers in a dusty cupboard at the back of the room. The name of von Ulrich did not appear here either, but there was one document missing. According to the list pinned to the inside of the cupboard door, there should have been a file of 117 pages entitled Vice Establishments. It sounded like a survey of Berlin's nightclubs. Macker could guess why it was not here. It must have been in use recently. All the more decadent night spots had been closed down when Hitler became Chancellor. Macker went back upstairs. Klingelein was briefing uniformed police who were to raid the updated addresses Macker had provided for communists and their allies. Macker did not hesitate to interrupt his boss. Klingelein was not a Nazi, and would therefore be afraid to reprimand a stormtrooper. Macker said, "I'm looking for the Vice Establishment's file." Klingelein looked annoyed but made no protest. "On the side table," he said, "help yourself." Macker took the file and returned to his own room. The survey was 5 years old. It detailed the clubs then in existence and stated what activities went on in them: gambling, indecent displays, prostitution, sale of drugs, homosexuality, and other depravities. The file named owners and investors, club members and employees. Macker patiently read each entry. Perhaps Robert von Ulrich was a drug addict or a user of whores. Berlin was famous for its homosexual clubs. Macker ploughed through the dreary entry on The Pink Slipper, where men danced with men and the floor show featured transvestite singers. Sometimes, he thought, his work was disgusting. He ran his finger down the list of members and found Robert von Ulrich. He gave a sigh of satisfaction. Looking farther down, he saw the name of Jürg Schleicher.
"Well, well," he said, "let's see how sarcastic you are now."
4. The next time Lloyd saw Walter and Maud, he found them angrier and more scared. It was the following Saturday, March 4th, the day before the election. Lloyd and Ethel were planning to attend a Social Democratic Party rally organized by Walter, and they went to the von Ulrich's home in Mitte for lunch beforehand. It was a 19th-century house with spacious rooms and large windows, though much of the furniture was worn. The lunch was plain, pork chops with potatoes and cabbage, but there was good wine with it. Walter and Maud talked as if they were poor, and no doubt they were living more simply than their parents had, but all the same they were not going hungry. However, they were frightened. Hitler had persuaded Germany's aging president, Paul von Hindenburg, to approve the Reichstag Fire Decree, which gave the Nazis authority for what they were already doing, beating and torturing their political opponents. 20,000 people have been arrested since Monday night, Walter said, his voice shaking. Not just communists, but people the Nazis call communist sympathizers. Which means anyone they dislike, said Maud. Ethel said, how can there be a democratic election now? We must do our best, Walter said. If we don't campaign, it will only help the Nazis. Lloyd said impatiently, "When will you stop accepting this and start to fight back? Do you still believe it would be wrong to meet violence with violence?"
"Absolutely," said Maud. "Peaceful resistance is our only hope."
Walter said, "The Social Democratic Party has a paramilitary wing, the Reichsbanner, but it's weak. A small group of Social Democrats proposed a violent response to the Nazis, but they were outvoted."
Maud said, "Remember, Lloyd, the Nazis have the police and the army on their side."
Walter looked at his pocket watch.
"We must get going."
Maud said suddenly,
"Walter, why don't you cancel?"
He stared at her in surprise.
700 tickets have been sold."
"Out of blazes with the tickets," Maud said. "I'm worried about you."
"Don't worry. Seats have been carefully allocated, so there should be no troublemakers in the hall."
Lloyd was not sure Walter was as confident as he pretended. Walter went on, "Anyway, I cannot let down people who are still willing to come to a democratic political meeting. They are all the hope that remains to us."
"You're right," Maud said. She looked at Ethel. "Perhaps you and Lloyd should stay home. It's dangerous, no matter what Walter says. And this isn't your country after all."
"Socialism is international," Ethel said stoutly. "Like your husband, I appreciate your concern, but I'm here to witness German politics firsthand, and I'm not going to miss this."
"Well, the children can't go," Maud said.
Eric, the son, said, "I don't even want to go."
Carla looked disappointed, but said nothing. Walter, Maud, Ethel, and Lloyd got into Walter's little car. Lloyd was nervous, but excited too. He was getting a perspective on politics superior to anything his friends back home had, and if there was going to be a fight, he was not afraid. They drove east, across Alexanderplatz, into a neighborhood of poor houses and small shops, some of which had signs in Hebrew letters. The Social Democratic Party was working class, but like the British Labour Party, it had a few affluent supporters. Walter von Ulrich was in a small, upper-class minority. The car pulled up outside a marquee that said, "People's Theatre." A line had already formed outside. Walter crossed the pavement to the door, waving to the waiting crowd, who cheered. Lloyd and the others followed him inside. Walter shook hands with a solemn young man of about 18. "This is Wilhelm Frunze, secretary of the local branch of our party." Frunze was one of those boys who looked as if they had been born middle-aged. He wore a blazer with buttoned pockets that had been fashionable 10 years ago. Frunze showed Walter how the theatre doors could be barred from the inside.
"When the audience is seated, we will lock up so that no troublemakers can get in," he said.
"Very good," said Walter. "Well done."
Frunze ushered them into the auditorium. Walter went up on stage and greeted some other candidates who were already there. The public began to come in and take their seats. Frunze showed Maud, Ethel, and Lloyd to reserved places in the front row. Two boys approached. The younger, who looked about 14 but was taller than Lloyd, greeted Maud with careful good manners and made a little bow. Maud turned to Ethel and said,
"This is Werner Frank, the son of my friend Monica."
Then she said to Werner, "Does your father know you're here?"
"Yes, he said I should find out about social democracy myself."
"He's broad-minded, for a Nazi." Lloyd thought this was a rather tough line to take with a 14-year-old, but Werner was a match for her.
"My father doesn't really believe in Nazism, but he thinks Hitler is good for German business."
Wilhelm Frunze said indignantly,
"How can it be good for business to throw thousands of people into jail? Apart from the injustice, they can't work."
Werner said, "I agree with you, and yet Hitler's crackdown is popular."
"People think they're being saved from a Bolshevik revolution," Frunze said. "The Nazi press has them convinced that the communists were about to launch a campaign of murder, arson, and poison in every town and village."
The boy with Werner, who was shorter but older, said, "And yet it is the brown shirts, not the communists, who drag people into basements and break their bones with clubs." He spoke German fluently, with a slight accent that Lloyd could not place.
Werner said, "Forgive me. I forgot to introduce Vladimir Peshkov. He goes to the Berlin Boys Academy, my school, and he's always called Volotya."
Lloyd stood up to shake hands. Volotya was about Lloyd's age, a striking young man with a frank, blue-eyed gaze. Frunze said,
I know, Volodya Peshkov. I go to the Berlin Boys' Academy, too.
Volodya said, Wilhelm Frunze is the school genius. Top marks in physics and chemistry and math.
It's true, said Werner.
Maud looked hard at Volodya and said,
Peshkov, is your father Grigori?
Yes, Frau von Ulrich. He is a military attaché at the Soviet embassy.
So Volodya is Russian. He speaks German effortlessly, Lloyd thought with a touch of envy. No doubt that comes from living here.
I know your parents well, Maud said to Volodya.
She knew all the diplomats in Berlin. Lloyd had already gathered. It was part of her job. Frunze checked his watch and said,
Time to begin.
He went up on stage and called for order. The theater went quiet. Frunze announced that the candidates would make speeches and then take questions from the audience. Tickets had been issued only to Social Democratic Party members, he added, and the doors were now closed, so everyone could speak freely, knowing they were among friends. It was like being a member of a secret society, Lloyd thought. This was not what he called democracy. Walter spoke first. He was no demagogue, Lloyd observed. He had no rhetorical flourishes. But he flattered his audience, telling them they were intelligent and well-informed men and women who understood the complexity of political issues. He had been speaking for only a few minutes when a brown shirt walked on stage. Lloyd cursed. How had he got in? He came from the wings. Someone must have opened the stage door. He was a huge brute with an army haircut. He stepped to the front of the stage and shouted, This is a seditious gathering. Communists and subversives are not wanted in today's Germany. This meeting is closed. The confident arrogance of the man outraged Lloyd. He wished he could get this great oaf in a boxing ring. Wilhelm Frunze leaped to his feet, stood in front of the intruder, and yelled furiously, Get out of here, you thug! The man shoved him in the chest powerfully. Frunze staggered back, stumbled, and fell over backward. The audience were on their feet, some shouting in angry protest, some screaming in fear. More brown shirts appeared from the wings. Lloyd realized with dismay that the bastards had planned this well. The man who had shoved Frunze shouted, Out! The other brown shirts took up the cry, Out! 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 There were about 20 of them now, and more appearing all the time. Some carried police nightsticks or improvised clubs. Lloyd saw a hockey stick, a wooden sledgehammer, even a chair leg. They strutted up and down the stage, grinning fiendishly and waving the weapons as they chanted, and Lloyd had no doubt they were itching to start hitting people. He was on his feet. Without thinking, he, Werner, and Volodya had formed a protective line in front of Ethel and Maud. Half the audience were trying to leave, the other half shouting and shaking their fists at the intruders. Those attempting to get out were shoving others, and minor scuffles had broken out. Many of the women were crying. On stage, Walter grasped the lectern and shouted,
Everyone try to keep calm, please. There is no need for disorder.
Most people could not hear, and the rest ignored him. The brown shirts began to jump off the stage and wade into the audience. Lloyd took his mother's arm, and Werner did the same with Maud. They moved toward the nearest exit in a group. But all the doors were already jammed with knots of panicking people trying to leave. That made no difference to the brown shirts, who kept yelling at people to get out. The attackers were mostly able-bodied, whereas the audience included women and old men. Lloyd wanted to fight back, but it was not a good idea. A man in a Great War steel helmet shouldered Lloyd, and he lurched forward and bumped into his mother. He resisted the temptation to turn and confront the man. His priority was to protect Mam. A spotty-faced boy carrying a truncheon put a hand on Werner's back and shoved energetically, yelling, Get out! Get out! Werner turned quickly and took a step toward him.
Don't touch me, you fascist pig, he said.
The brown shirt suddenly stopped dead and looked scared, as if he had not been expecting resistance. Werner turned away again, concentrating like Lloyd on getting the two women to safety. But the huge man had heard the exchange and yelled, Who are you calling a pig? He lashed out at Werner, hitting the back of his head with his fist. His aim was poor, and it was a glancing blow, but all the same Werner cried out and staggered forward. Volodya stepped between them and hit the big man in the face, twice. Lloyd admired Volodya's rapid 1-2, but turned his attention back to his task. Seconds later, the four of them reached the doorway. Lloyd and Werner managed to help the women out into the theater foyer. Here the crush eased, and the violence stopped. There were no brown shirts. Seeing the women safe, Lloyd and Werner looked back into the auditorium. Volodya was fighting the big man bravely, but he was in trouble. He kept punching the man's face and body, but his blows had little effect, and the man shook his head as if pestered by an insect. The brown shirt was heavy-footed and slow-moving, but he hit Volodya in the chest, and then the head, and Volodya staggered. The big man drew back his fist for a massive punch. Lloyd was afraid it could kill Volodya. Then Walter took a flying leap off the stage and landed on the big man's back. Lloyd wanted to cheer. They fell to the floor in a blur of arms and legs, and Volodya was saved, for the moment. The spotty youth who had shoved Werner was now harassing the people trying to leave, hitting their backs and heads with his truncheon.
"You fucking coward!"
Lloyd yelled, stepping forward. But Werner was ahead of him. He shoved past Lloyd and grabbed the truncheon, trying to wrestle it away from the youth. The older man in the steel helmet joined in and hit Werner with a pickaxe handle. Lloyd stepped forward and hit the older man with a straight right. The blow landed perfectly, next to the man's left eye. But he was a war veteran, and not easily discouraged. He swung around and lashed out at Lloyd with his club. Lloyd dodged the blow easily and hit him twice more. He connected in the same area, around the man's eyes, breaking the skin. But the helmet protected the man's head, and Lloyd could not land a left hook, his knockout punch. He ducked a swing of the pickaxe handle and hit the man's face again, and the man backed away, blood pouring from cuts around his eyes. Lloyd looked around. He saw the Social Democrats were fighting back now, and he got a jolt of savage pleasure. Most of the audience had passed through the doors, leaving mainly young men in the auditorium, and they were coming forward, clambering over the theater seats to get at the brown shirts. There were dozens of them. Something hard struck his head from behind. It was so painful that he roared. He turned to see a boy of his own age holding a length of timber, raising it to strike again. Lloyd closed in on him and hit him hard in the stomach twice, first with his right fist, then with his left. The boy gasped for breath and dropped the wood. Lloyd hit him with an uppercut to the chin and he passed out. Lloyd rubbed the back of his head. It hurt like hell, but there was no blood. The skin on his knuckles was raw and bleeding, he saw. He bent down and picked up the length of timber dropped by the boy. When he looked around again, he was thrilled to see some of the brown shirts retreating, clambering up onto the stage and disappearing into the wings, presumably aiming to leave through the stage door by which they had entered. The big man who had started it all was on the floor, groaning and holding his knee as if he had dislocated something. Wilhelm Frunzer stood over him, hitting him with a wooden shovel again and again, repeating at the top of his voice the words the man had used to start the riot, "Not wanted in today's Germany." Helpless, the big man tried to roll away from the blows, but Frunzer went after him, until two more brown shirts grabbed the man's arms and dragged him away. Frunzer let them go.
"Did we beat them?" Lloyd thought with growing exultation. "Maybe we did."
Several of the younger men chased their opponents up onto the stage, but they stopped there and contented themselves with shouting insults as the brown shirts disappeared. Lloyd looked at the others. Volodya had a swollen face and one closed eye. Werner's jacket was ripped, a big square of cloth dangling. Walter was sitting on a front row seat, breathing hard and rubbing his elbow, but he was smiling. Frunzer threw his shovel away, sailing it across the rows of empty seats to the back. Werner, who was only 14, was exultant.
"We gave them hell, didn't we?"
Lloyd grinned. "Yes, we certainly did."
Volodya put his arm around Frunze's shoulders.
"Not bad for a bunch of schoolboys, eh?"
Walter said, "But they stopped our meeting." The youngsters stared resentfully at him for spoiling their triumph. Walter looked angry.
"Be realistic, boys.
Our audience has fled in terror. How long will it be before those people have the nerve to go to a political meeting again? The Nazis have made their point. It's dangerous even to listen to any party other than theirs.
The big loser today is Germany.
Werner said to Volodya,
I hate those fucking brownshirts. I think I might join you communists.
Volodya looked at him hard with those intense blue eyes and spoke in a low voice.
If you're serious about fighting the Nazis, there might be something more effective you could do.
Lloyd wondered what Volodya meant. Then Maud and Ethel came running back into the auditorium, both speaking at the same time, crying and laughing with relief. And Lloyd forgot Volodya's words, and never thought of them again. 5. 4 days later, Erich von Ulrich came home in a Hitler Youth uniform. He felt like a prince. He had a brown shirt, just like the one worn by stormtroopers, with various patches and a swastika armband. He also had the regulation black tie and black shorts. He was a patriotic soldier dedicated to the service of his country. At last, he was one of the gang. This was even better than supporting Hertha, Berlin's favorite soccer team. Erich was taken to matches occasionally, on Saturdays when his father did not have a political meeting to attend. That gave him the same sense of belonging to a great big crowd of people all feeling the same emotions. But Hertha sometimes lost, and he came home disconsolate. The Nazis were winners. He was terrified of what his father was going to say. His parents infuriated him by insisting on marching out of step. All the boys were joining the Hitler Youth. They had sports and singing and adventures in the fields and forests outside the city. They were smart and fit and loyal and efficient. Erich was deeply troubled by the thought that he might have to fight in battle someday. His father and grandfather had, and he wanted to be ready for that, trained and hardened, disciplined and aggressive. The Nazis hated communists, but so did mother and father. So what if the Nazis hated Jews as well? The von Ulrichs were not Jewish. Why should they care? But mother and father stubbornly refused to join in. Well, Erich was fed up with being left out, and he had decided to defy them. He was scared stiff. As usual, neither mother nor father was at the house when Erich and Carla came home from school. Ada pursed her lips disapprovingly as she served their tea, but she said, You'll have to clear the table yourselves today. I've got a terrible backache. I'm going to lie down. Carla looked concerned. Is that what you had to see the doctor about? Ada hesitated before replying.
Yes, that's right.
She was obviously hiding something. The thought of Ada being ill and lying about it made Erich uneasy. He would never go as far as Carla and say he loved Ada, but she had been a kindly presence all his life, and he was more fond of her than he liked to say. Carla was just as concerned.
I hope it gets better.
Lately, Carla had become more grown up, somewhat to Erich's bewilderment. Although he was 2 years older, he still felt like a kid, but she acted like an adult half the time. Ada said reassuringly,
I'll be fine after a rest.
Erich ate some bread. When Ada left the room, he swallowed and said,
I'm only in the junior section, but as soon as I'm 14, I can move up.
Carla said, Father's going to hit the roof.
Are you mad?
Herr Lippmann said Father will be in trouble if he tries to make me leave.
Oh, brilliant, said Carla.
She had developed a streak of withering sarcasm that sometimes stung Erich.
So you'll get Father into a row with the Nazis, she said scornfully. What a great idea. So good for the whole family.
Erich was taken aback. He had not thought of it that way.
But all the boys in my class are members, he said indignantly, except for Frenchy Fontaine and Jewboy Rotman.
Carla spread fish paste on her bread.
Why do you have to be the same as the others? She said. Most of them are stupid. You told me Rudy Rotman was the cleverest boy in the class. I don't want to be with Frenchy and Rudy, Erich cried, and to his mortification he felt tears come to his eyes. Why should I have to play with the boys no one likes?
This was what had given him the courage to defy his father. He could no longer bear to walk out of school with the Jews and the foreigners, while all the German boys marched around the playing field in their uniforms. They both heard a cry. Erich looked at Carla and said,
What was that?
Carla frowned.
It was Ada, I think.
Then, more distinctly, they heard,
Help!
Erich got to his feet, but Carla was ahead of him. He went after her.
Ada's room was in the basement. They ran down the stairs and into the small bedroom. There was a narrow single bed up against the wall. Ada was lying there, her face screwed up in pain. Her skirt was wet, and there was a puddle on the floor. Eric could hardly believe what he was seeing. Had she pissed herself? It was scary. There were no other grown-ups in the house. He did not know what to do. Carla was scared, too. Eric could see it in her face, but she was not panicked. She said, "Ada, what's wrong?" Her voice sounded strangely calm.
"My water's broke,"
Ada said. Eric had no idea what that meant. Nor did Carla.
"I don't understand," she said. "It means my baby is coming." "You're pregnant?"
Carla said in astonishment. Eric said, "But you're not married." Carla said furiously,
"Shut up, Eric. Don't you know anything?"
He did know, of course, that women could have babies when they were not married, but surely not Ada.
"That's why you went to the doctor last week,"
Carla said to Ada. Ada nodded. Eric was still trying to get used to the idea.
"Do you think Mother and Father know?"
"Of course they do. They just don't tell us. Fetch a towel."
"Where from?"
"The airing cupboard on the upstairs landing."
"A clean one?"
"Of course a clean one."
Eric ran up the stairs, took a small white towel from the cupboard and ran down again.
"That's not much good,"
Carla said, but she took it and dried Ada's legs. Ada said,
"The baby's coming soon. I can feel it, but I don't know what to do."
She started to cry. Eric was watching Carla. She was in charge now. It did not matter that he was the older one. He looked to her for leadership. She was being practical and staying calm, but he could tell that she was terrified, and her composure was fragile. She could crack at any minute, he thought. Carla turned to Eric again.
"Go and fetch Dr. Rothman," she said. "You know where his office is."
Eric was hugely relieved to have been given a task he could manage. Then he thought of a snag.
"What if he's out?"
"Then ask Frau Rothman what you should do, you idiot,"
Carla said.
"Get going, run!"
Eric was glad to get out of the room. What was happening there was mysterious and frightening. He went up the stairs three at a time and flew out of the front door. Running was one thing he did know how to do. The doctor's surgery was half a mile away. He settled into a fast trot. As he ran, he thought about Ada. Who was the father of her baby? He recalled that she had gone to the movies with Paul Huber a couple of times last summer. Had they had sexual intercourse? They must have. Eric and his friends talked about sex a lot, but they did not really know anything about it. Where had Ada and Paul done it? Not in a movie theater, surely. Didn't people have to lie down? He was baffled. Dr. Rothman's place was in a poorer street. He was a good doctor, Eric had heard Mother say, but he treated a lot of working-class people who could not pay high fees. The doctor's house had a consulting room and a waiting room on the ground floor, and the family lived upstairs. Outside was parked a green Opel 4, an ugly little two-seater unofficially called the Tree Frog. The front door of the house was unlatched. Eric walked in, breathing hard, and entered the waiting room. There was an old man coughing in a corner and a young woman with a baby.
"Hello?" Eric called. "Dr. Rothman?"
The doctor's wife stepped out of the consulting room. Hannalore Rothman was a tall, fair woman with strong features, and she gave Eric a look like thunder.
"How dare you come to this house in that uniform?" she said.
Eric was petrified. Frau Rothman was not Jewish, but her husband was. Eric had forgotten that in his excitement.
"Our maid is having a baby," he said.
"And so you want a Jewish doctor to help you?" Eric was taken completely by surprise. It had never occurred to him that the Nazis' attacks might cause the Jews to retaliate. But suddenly he saw that Frau Rothman made total sense. The brown shirts went around shouting, "Death to Jews!" Why should a Jewish doctor help such people? Now he did not know what to do. There were other doctors, of course, plenty of them, but he did not know where, nor whether they would come out to see a total stranger.
"My sister sent me,"
he said feebly. Carla's got a lot more sense than you. Ada said the waters have broken.
Eric was not sure what that meant, but it sounded significant. With a disgusted look, Frau Rothman went back into the consulting room. The old man in the corner cackled.
"We're all dirty Jews until you need our help," he said. "Then it's, please come, Dr. Rothman, and what's your advice, Lawyer Koch? And lend me 100 marks, Herr Goldman, and—"
He was overcome by a fit of coughing. A girl of about 16 came in from the hall. Eric thought she must be the Rothman's daughter, Ava. He had not seen her for years. She had breasts now, but she was still plain and dumpy. She said, "Did your father let you join the Hitler Youth?"
"He doesn't know," said Eric.
"Oh boy," said Ava, "you're in trouble."
He looked from her to the consulting room door.
"Do you think your father's going to come?" he said.
"Your mother was awfully cross with me."
"Of course he'll come," Ava said. "If people are sick, he helps them."
Her voice became scornful.
"He doesn't check their race or politics first. We're not Nazis."
She went out again. Eric felt bewildered. He had not expected this uniform to get him into so much trouble. At school, everyone thought it was wonderful. A moment later, Dr. Rothman appeared. Speaking to the two waiting patients, he said,
"I'll be back as soon as I can. I'm sorry, but the baby won't wait to be born."
He looked at Eric.
"Come on, young man. You'd better ride with me despite that uniform."
Eric followed him out and got into the passenger seat of the Tree Frog. He loved cars and was desperate to be old enough to drive, and normally he enjoyed riding in any vehicle, watching the dials and studying the driver's technique. But now he felt as if he were on display, sitting beside a Jewish doctor in his brown shirt. What if Herr Lippmann should see him? The trip was agony. Fortunately, it was short. In a couple of minutes, they were at the von Ulrich house.
"What's the young woman's name?" Rothman said.
"Ada Hempel."
"Ah, yes. She came to see me last week. The baby's early. All right. Take me to her."
Eric led the way into the house. He heard a baby cry. It had come already. He hurried down to the basement, the doctor following. Ada lay on her back. The bed was soaked with blood and something else. Carla stood holding a tiny baby in her arms. The baby was covered in slime. Something that looked like thick string ran from the baby up Ada's skirt. Carla was wide-eyed with terror.
"What must I do?" she cried.
"You're doing exactly the right thing," Dr. Rothman reassured her. "Just hold that baby close a minute longer."
He sat beside Ada. He listened to her heart, took her pulse, and said,
"How do you feel, my dear?"
"I'm so tired," she said.
Rothman gave a satisfied nod. He stood up again and looked at the baby in Carla's arms.
"A little boy," he said.
Eric watched with a mixture of fascination and revulsion as the doctor opened his bag, took out some thread, and tied 2 knots in the cord. While he was doing so, he spoke to Carla in a soft voice.
"Why are you crying? You've done a marvelous job. You've delivered the baby all on your own. You hardly needed me. You'd better be a doctor when you grow up."
Carla became calmer. Then she whispered,
"Look at his head."
The doctor had to lean toward her to hear.
"I think there's something wrong with him."
"I know."
The doctor took out a pair of sharp scissors and cut the cord between the 2 knots. Then he took the naked baby from Carla and held him at arm's length, studying him. Eric could not see anything wrong, but the baby was so red and wrinkled and slimy that it was hard to tell. However, after a thoughtful moment, the doctor said,
"Oh dear."
Looking more carefully, Eric could see that there was something wrong. The baby's face was lopsided. One side was normal, but on the other, the head seemed dented, and there was something strange about the eye. Rothman handed the baby back to Carla. Ada groaned again and seemed to strain. When she relaxed, Rothman reached under her skirt and drew out a lump of something that looked disgustingly like meat.
"Eric," he said, "fetch me a newspaper."
Eric said,
"Which one?"
His parents took all the main papers every day.
Anyone, lad, said Rothman gently. I don't want to read it.
Eric ran upstairs and found yesterday's Vossische Zeitung. When he returned, the doctor wrapped the meaty thing in the paper and put it on the floor.
It's what we call the afterbirth, he said to Carla.
Best to burn it, later. Then he sat on the edge of the bed again.
Ada, my dear girl, you must be very brave, he said. Your baby is alive, but there may be something wrong with him. We're going to wash him and wrap him up warmly. Then we must take him to the hospital.
Ada looked frightened. What's the matter?
I don't know. We need to have him checked.
Will he be all right?
The hospital doctors will do everything they can. The rest we must leave to God.
Eric remembered that Jews worshipped the same God as Christians. It was easy to forget that. Rothman said, Do you think you could get up and come to the hospital with me, Ada?
Baby needs you to feed him.
I'm so tired, she said again.
Take a minute or two to rest, then, but not much more, because baby needs to be looked at soon. Carla will help you get rest. I'll wait upstairs.
He addressed Eric with gentle irony.
Come with me, little Nazi.
Eric wanted to squirm. Dr. Rothman's forbearance was even worse than Frau Rothman's scorn. As they were leaving, Ada said,
Doctor?
Yes, my dear.
His name is Kurt.
A very good name, said Dr. Rothman.
He went out, and Eric followed. 6. Lloyd Williams's first day working as assistant to Walter von Ulrich was also the first day of the new parliament. Walter and Maud were struggling frantically to save Germany's fragile democracy. Lloyd shared their desperation, partly because they were good people whom he had known off and on all his life, and partly because he feared that Britain could follow Germany down the road to hell. The election had resolved nothing. The Nazis got 44%, an increase, but still short of the 51% they craved. Walter saw hope. Driving to the opening of the parliament, he said, Even with massive intimidation, they failed to win the votes of most Germans. He banged his fist on the steering wheel. Despite everything they say, they are not popular, and the longer they stay in government, the better people will get to know their wickedness. Lloyd was not so sure. They've closed opposition newspapers, thrown Reichstag deputies in jail, and corrupted the police, he said. And yet 44% of Germans approve? I don't find that reassuring. The Reichstag building was badly fire-damaged and quite unusable, so the parliament assembled in the Kroll Opera House, on the opposite side of the Königsplatz. It was a vast complex with 3 concert halls and 14 smaller auditoria, plus restaurants and bars. When they arrived, they had a shock. The place was surrounded by brown shirts. Deputies and their aides crowded around the entrances, trying to get in. Walter said furiously, Is this how Hitler plans to get his way? By preventing us from entering the chamber? Lloyd saw that the doors were barred by brown shirts. They admitted those in Nazi uniform without question, but everyone else had to produce credentials. A boy younger than Lloyd looked him up and down, contemptuously, before grudgingly letting him in. This was intimidation, pure and simple. Lloyd felt his temper beginning to simmer. He hated to be bullied. He knew he could knock the brown shirt boy down with one good left hook. He forced himself to remain calm, turn away, and walk through the door. After the fight in the People's Theatre, his mother had examined the egg-shaped lump on his head and ordered him to go home to England. He had talked her round, but it had been a close thing. She said he had no sense of danger, but that was not quite right. He did get scared sometimes, but it always made him feel combative. His instinct was to go on the attack, not to retreat. This scared his mother. Ironically, she was just the same. She was not going home. She was frightened, but she was also thrilled to be here in Berlin at this turning point in German history, and outraged by the violence and repression she was witnessing, and she felt sure she could write a book that would forewarn Democrats in other countries about fascist tactics. You're worse than me, Lloyd had said to her, and she had had no answer. Inside,
The opera house was swarming with brown shirts and SS men, many of them armed. They guarded every door and showed, with looks and gestures, their hatred and contempt for anyone not supporting the Nazis. Walter was late for a Social Democratic Party group meeting. Lloyd hurried around the building looking for the right room. Glancing into the debating chamber, he saw that a giant swastika hung from the ceiling, dominating the room. The first matter to be discussed, when proceedings began that afternoon, was to be the Enabling Act, which would permit Hitler's cabinet to pass laws without the approval of the Reichstag. The act offered a dreadful prospect. It would make Hitler a dictator. The repression, intimidation, violence, torture, and murder that Germany had seen in the past few weeks would become permanent. It was unthinkable. But Lloyd could not imagine that any parliament in the world would pass such a law. They would be voting themselves out of power. It was political suicide. He found the Social Democrats in a small auditorium. Their meeting had already begun. Lloyd hurried Walter to the room. Then he was sent for coffee. Waiting in the queue, he found himself behind a pale, intense-looking young man dressed in funereal black. Lloyd's German had become more fluent and colloquial, and he now had the confidence to strike up a conversation with a stranger. The man in black was Heinrich von Kessel, he learned. He was doing the same sort of job as Lloyd, working as an unpaid aide to his father, Gottfried von Kessel, a deputy for the Centre Party, which was Catholic. "My father knows Walter von Ulrich very well," Heinrich said. "They were both attachés at the German embassy in London in 1914. The world of international politics and diplomacy was quite small, Lloyd reflected. Heinrich told Lloyd that a return to the Christian faith was the answer to Germany's problems. "I'm not much of a Christian," Lloyd said candidly. "I hope you don't mind my saying so. My grandparents are Welsh Bible punchers, but my mother is indifferent, and my stepfather's Jewish. Occasionally we go to the Calvary Gospel Hall in Aldgate, mainly because the pastor is a Labour Party member." Heinrich smiled and said, "I'll pray for you." Catholics were not proselytizers, Lloyd remembered. What a contrast with his dogmatic grandparents in Aberowen, who thought that people who did not believe as they did were willfully blinding themselves to the gospel and would be condemned to eternal damnation. When Lloyd re-entered the Social Democratic Party meeting, Walter was speaking.
"It can't happen," he said. "The Enabling Act is a constitutional amendment. 2/3 of the representatives must be present, which would be 432 out of a possible 647, and 2/3 of those present must approve."
Lloyd added up the numbers in his head as he put the tray down on the table. The Nazis had 288 seats, and the Nationalists, who were their close allies, had 52, making 340, nearly 100 short. Walter was right. The act could not be passed. Lloyd was comforted and sat down to listen to the discussion and improve his German. But his relief was short-lived.
"Don't be so sure," said a man with a working-class Berlin accent. "The Nazis are caucusing with the Centre Party."
That was Heinrich's lot, Lloyd recalled.
"That could give them another 74, the man finished.
Lloyd frowned. Why would the Centre Party support a measure that would take away all its power? Walter voiced the same thought more bluntly.
"How could the Catholics be so stupid?"
Lloyd wished he had known about this before he went for coffee. Then he could have discussed it with Heinrich. He might have learned something useful.
Damn.
The man with the Berlin accent said,
"In Italy, the Catholics made a deal with Mussolini, a concordat to protect the church. Why not here?"
Lloyd calculated that the Centre Party support would bring the Nazis' vote up to 414. "It's still not 2/3, he said to Walter with relief. Another young aide heard him and said,
"But that doesn't take into account the Reichstag president's latest announcement."
The Reichstag president was Hermann Göring, Hitler's closest associate. Lloyd had not heard about an announcement, nor had anyone else, it seemed. The deputies went quiet. The aide went on.
"He has ruled that communist deputies who are absent because they're in jail don't count."
There was an outburst of indignant protest all around the room. Lloyd saw Walter go red in the face.
"He can't do that," Walter said. It's completely illegal, said the aide. But he has done it.
Lloyd was dismayed. Surely the law could not be passed by a trick. He did some more arithmetic. The communists had 81 seats. If they were discounted, the Nazis needed only 2/3 of 566, which was 378. Even with the nationalists, they still did not have enough. But if they won the support of the Catholics, they could swing it. Someone said, "This is all completely illegal. We should walk out in protest."
"No, no," said Walter emphatically. "They would pass the act in our absence. We've got to talk the Catholics out of it. Wels must speak to Kass immediately."
Otto Wels was the leader of the Social Democratic Party, Prelate Ludwig Kass the head of the Center Party. There was a murmur of agreement around the room. Lloyd took a deep breath and spoke up. "Herr von Ulrich, why don't you take Gottfried von Kessel to lunch? I believe you two worked together in London before the war."
Walter laughed mirthlessly.
"That creep," he said.
Maybe the lunch was not such a good idea. Lloyd said, "I didn't realize you disliked the man."
Walter looked thoughtful. "I hate him. But I'll try anything, by God."
Lloyd said, "Shall I find him and extend the invitation?"
"All right. Give it a try.
If he accepts, tell him to meet me at the Herren Club at 1.
"Very good."
Lloyd hurried back to the room into which Heinrich had disappeared. He stepped inside. A meeting was going on similar to the one he had left. He scanned the room, spotted the black-clad Heinrich, met his gaze, and beckoned him urgently. They both stepped outside. Then Lloyd said,
"They're saying your party is going to support the Enabling Act."
"It's not certain," said Heinrich. "They're divided."
"Who's against the Nazis?"
"Bröning and some others." Bröning was a former chancellor and a leading figure. Lloyd felt more hopeful.
"Which others?"
"Did you call me out of the room to pump me for information?"
"Sorry, no, I didn't. Walter von Ulrich wants to have lunch with your father."
Heinrich looked dubious. "They don't like each other. You know that, don't you?"
"I gathered as much, but they'll put their differences aside today."
Heinrich did not seem sure.
"I'll ask him. Wait here."
He went back inside. Lloyd wondered whether there was any chance this would work. It was a shame Walter and Gottfried were not bosom buddies, but he could hardly believe the Catholics would vote with the Nazis. What bothered him most was the thought that if it could happen in Germany, it could happen in Britain. This grim prospect made him shiver with dread. He had his whole life in front of him, and he did not want to live it in a repressive dictatorship. He wanted to work in politics like his parents, and make his country a better place for people such as the Aberowan coal miners. For that, he needed political meetings where people could speak their minds, and newspapers that could attack the government, and pubs where men could have arguments without looking over their shoulders to see who was listening. Fascism threatened all that. But perhaps fascism would fail. Walter might be able to talk Gottfried around, and prevent the Center Party supporting the Nazis. Heinrich came out.
"He'll do it."
"Great. Herr von Ulrich suggested the Herren Club at 1 o'clock.
"Really? Is he a member?"
"I assume so.
Why?"
"It's a conservative institution. I suppose he is Walter von Ulrich, so he must come from a noble family, even if he is a socialist.
I should probably book a table. Do you know where it is?"
"Just around the corner."
Heinrich gave Lloyd directions.
"Shall I book for 4?
Heinrich grinned.
"Why not? If they don't want you and meet her, they can just ask us to leave."
He went back into the room. Lloyd left the building and walked quickly across the plaza, passing the burned-out Reichstag building, and made his way to the Herren Club. There were gentlemen's clubs in London, but Lloyd had never been inside one. This place was a cross between a restaurant and a funeral parlor, he thought. Waiters in full evening dress padded about, laying silent cutlery on tables shrouded in white. A head waiter took his reservation and wrote down the name von Ulrich, as solemnly as if he were making an entry in the Book of the Dead. He returned to the opera house. The place was getting busier and noisier, and the tension seemed higher. Lloyd heard someone say excitedly that Hitler himself would open the proceedings this afternoon by proposing the act.
A few minutes before one, Lloyd and Walter walked across the plaza. Lloyd said, "Heinrich von Kessel was surprised to learn that you are a member of the Heron Club." Walter nodded. "I was one of the founders, a decade or more ago. In those days it was the Unique Club. We got together to campaign against the Versailles Treaty. It's become a right-wing bastion, and I'm probably the only social democrat. But I remain a member because it's a useful place to meet with the enemy." Inside the club, Walter pointed to a sleek-looking man at the bar. "That's Ludwig Frank, the father of young Werner, who fought alongside us at the People's Theater," Walter said. "I'm sure he's not a member here. He isn't even German-born. But it seems he's having lunch with his father-in-law, Count von der Helbart, the elderly man beside him. Come with me." They went to the bar and Walter performed introductions. Frank said to Lloyd, "You and my son got into quite a scrap a couple of weeks back." Lloyd touched the back of his head reflexively. The swelling had gone down, but the place was still painful to touch. "We had women to protect, sir," he said. "Nothing wrong with a bit of a punch-up," Frank said. "Does you lads good?" Walter cut in impatiently. "Come on, Ludi. Busting up election meetings is bad enough, but your leader wants to completely destroy our democracy." "Perhaps democracy is not the right form of government for us," said Frank. "After all, we're not like the French or the Americans, thank God." "Don't you care about losing your freedom? Be serious." Frank suddenly dropped his facetious air. "All right, Walter," he said coldly. "I will be serious, if you insist. My mother and I arrived here from Russia more than 10 years ago. My father was not able to come with us. He had been found to be in possession of subversive literature, specifically a book called Robinson Crusoe, apparently a novel that promotes bourgeois individualism, whatever the hell that might be. He was sent to a prison camp somewhere in the Arctic. He may—" Frank's voice broke for a moment, and he paused, swallowed, and at last finished quietly, "He may still be there." There was a moment of silence. Lloyd was shocked by the story. He knew that the Russian communist government could be cruel in general, but it was quite another thing to hear a personal account, told simply by a man who was clearly still grieving. Walter said, "Ludi, we all hate the Bolsheviks, but the Nazis could be worse." "I'm willing to take that risk," said Frank. Count von der Helbart said, "We'd better go in for lunch. I've got an afternoon appointment. Excuse us." The two men left. "It's what they always say," Walter raged. "The Bolsheviks, as if they were the only alternative to the Nazis. I could weep." Heinrich walked in with an older man who was obviously his father. They had the same thick dark hair combed with a parting, except that Gottfried's was shorter and tweeded with silver. Although their features were similar, Gottfried looked like a fussy bureaucrat in an old-fashioned collar, whereas Heinrich was more like a romantic poet than a political aide. The four of them went into the dining room. Walter wasted no time. As soon as they had ordered, he said, "I can't understand what your party hopes to gain by supporting this enabling act, Gottfried." Von Kessel was equally direct. "We are a Catholic party, and our first duty is to protect the position of the Church in Germany. That's what people hope for when they vote for us." Lloyd frowned in disapproval. His mother had been a member of Parliament, and she always said it was her duty to serve the people who did not vote for her, as well as those who did. Walter employed a different argument. "A democratic parliament is the best protection for all our churches, yet you're about to throw that away."
"Wake up, Walter," Gottfried said testily. "Hitler won the election. He has come to power. Whatever we do, he's going to rule Germany for the foreseeable future. We have to protect ourselves."
"His promises are worth nothing."
"We have asked for specific assurances in writing. The Catholic Church to be independent of the state, Catholic schools to operate unmolested, no discrimination against Catholics in the civil service." He looked inquiringly at his son. Heinrich said, "They promised the agreement would be with us first thing this afternoon." Walter said,
"Weigh the options.
A scrap of paper signed by a tyrant against a democratic parliament. Which is better?"
"The greatest power of all is God."
Walter rolled his eyes.
Then God save Germany, he said.
The Germans had not had time to develop faith in democracy, Lloyd reflected, as the argument surged back and forth between Walter and Gottfried. The Reichstag had been sovereign for only 14 years. They had lost a war, seen their currency devalued to nothing, and suffered mass unemployment. To them, the right to vote seemed inadequate protection. Gottfried proved immovable. At the end of lunch, his position was as firm as ever. His responsibility was to protect the Catholic Church. It made Lloyd want to scream. They returned to the opera house, and the deputies took their seats in the auditorium. Lloyd and Heinrich sat in a box, looking down. Lloyd could see the Social Democratic Party members in a group on the far left. As the hour approached, he noticed brown shirts and SS men placing themselves at the exits and around the walls in a threatening arc behind the Social Democrats. It was almost as if they planned to prevent the deputies leaving the building until they had passed the act. Lloyd found it powerfully sinister. He wondered, with a shiver of fear, whether he too might find himself imprisoned here. There was a roar of cheering and applause, and Hitler walked in, wearing a brown shirt uniform. The Nazi deputies, most of them similarly dressed, rose to their feet in ecstasy as he mounted the rostrum. Only the Social Democrats remained seated, but Lloyd noticed that one or two looked uneasily over their shoulders at the armed guards. How could they speak and vote freely if they were nervous even about not joining in the standing ovation for their opponent? When at last they became quiet, Hitler began to speak. He stood straight, his left arm at his side, gesturing only with his right. His voice was harsh and grating but powerful, reminding Lloyd of both a machine gun and the barking dog. His tone thrilled with feeling as he spoke of the November traitors of 1918, who had surrendered when Germany was about to win the war. He was not pretending. Lloyd felt he sincerely believed every stupid, ignorant word he spoke. The November traitors were a well-worn topic for Hitler, but then he took a new tack. He spoke of the churches, and the important place of the Christian religion in the German state. This was an unusual theme for him, and his words were clearly aimed at the Center Party, whose votes would determine today's result. He said that he saw the two main denominations, Protestant and Catholic, as the most important factors for upholding nationhood. Their rights would not be touched by the Nazi government. Heinrich shot a triumphant look at Lloyd.
I'd still get it in writing if I were you, Lloyd muttered.
It was 2.5 hours before Hitler reached his peroration. He ended with an unmistakable threat of violence.
The government of the nationalist uprising is determined and ready to deal with the announcement that the act has been rejected, and with it, that resistance has been declared.
He paused dramatically, letting the message sink in. Voting against the act would be a declaration of resistance. Then he reinforced it.
May you, gentlemen, now take the decision yourselves as to whether it is to be peace or war.
He sat down to roars of approval from the Nazi delegates, and the session was adjourned. Heinrich was elated, Lloyd depressed. They went off in different directions. Their parties would now hold desperate last-minute discussions. The Social Democrats were gloomy. Their leader, Wels, had to speak in the chamber. But what could he say? Several deputies said that if he criticized Hitler, he might not leave the building alive. They feared for their own lives, too. If the deputies were killed, Lloyd thought in a moment of cold dread, what would happen to their aides? Wels revealed that he had a cyanide capsule in his waistcoat pocket. If arrested, he would commit suicide to avoid torture. Lloyd was horrified. Wels was an elected representative, yet he was forced to behave like some kind of saboteur. Lloyd had started the day with false expectations.